their victims, et cetera.
Great. How is the organization put together as far as, you know, different people? You mentioned people in, you know, conflict resolution, restorative justice. So how do people get involved?
You know, people have just found out about us. We've presented a few years now at the Northwest Justice Forum. Many of us are involved in prison work, and so people will learn about our programs. We've also, you know, we put calls out for volunteers when we start new groups, so people learn that way. So it's just been a variety of ways that people have gotten involved over the years. We are comprised of a sort of a main steering committee body, so that group is, most of us have been around at least since 2010, and we've also over the years expanded a bit. So we have partnerships at OSC, Oregon State Penitentiary, and then we've also started a group at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility.
Sounds great. We'll get back to about, you know, how people can get more specifically involved in a few minutes. But just to backtrack a sec, you know, there are some listeners who might not be super familiar with the idea of restorative justice, and specifically maybe how it relates to, you know, prison justice work or what have you. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So restorative justice, you know, there are different ideas about restorative justice. And just up front, there are critics of restorative justice who would say that it's soft on crime. And I think those of us that are close to this work feel it's quite the opposite, that our current criminal justice system really separates people. It stops people from connecting and talking to each other about what's happened, which is really crucial when a harm has been committed. So restorative justice, just as an overview, it's an approach to dealing with crime and an impact of a harm that has been done, and it includes all the people who have been impacted by that harm. So it involves the offender, it involves the victim, it involves the community. So everybody's voice is important in figuring out how to move forward and deal with that harm. And it's, you know, the aim is how to restore the people that have been hurt. And it also believes that the people who commit harms are also hurt in that process.
It's a really amazing and powerful concept in itself. And if I can ask, why do you think it's taken so long, you know, to get people on board with this? I mean, you mentioned people who are, you know, critics that say it's soft on crime and things like that. So yeah, what's the deal?
You know, it's a complex issue. I think a lot of it is maybe, or some of it is partially having an unfamiliarity with how our criminal justice system works. So in my day job, I also happen to work as a victim advocate, and that's given me a unique perspective, because until you encounter the criminal justice system, I think people really don't understand how it works. So then here's this thing one more step removed from our systems. It's, you know, it's becoming more widespread and used more commonly in our society and around the world, but it's still a fringe thing. So I think people just aren't informed. And then when people are impacted by harm or have a crime happen to them, you know, there's not necessarily ever going to be one response that is going to work for everybody. So there is often a lot of anger, and people might want retribution. And, you know, in our work, we believe that that's all something that needs to be voiced and also considered. So I don't know. I think there's just people don't necessarily know how it works. And I think across the restorative justice spectrum and the people doing this work, like I mentioned at the beginning, it's not like there's one philosophy necessarily of restorative justice. People are doing different things in the restorative justice realm, and so maybe it's also just harder for people to grab onto.
Sure, sure. And, I mean, obviously, you know, these different forms of restorative justices are alternatives to prison, whether people are, you know, calling it you know, prison abolition, or they're just in different schools of like prison reform or what have you. But in contrast to, I mean, the system that we have now, prison industrial complex, what does it show, you know, the potential for again, in contrast to what things are like now, which clearly to many of us, right, are not working maybe at all.
I mean, I think restorative justice, going back to the restorative justice approach, I think what I see with the men and the youth that I work with, but also with the victims that I work with in my day job, is that people are really disconnected, and there's a web that's been broken. And even if you've been harmed by somebody you've never met, you now have a relationship. You're in this forced relationship. And allowing people to voice what they need and allowing people to actually apologize, it's been extremely humbling for me to work with so many different men on the inside who really wish that they could impact a change on what they did to their victim. They really want to be accountable. They really want to repair the harm they've done. And most of them will never have that opportunity. And that's part of our work, one of the steps in restorative justice might be victim offender meetings. And like the Oregon Department of Corrections does have a program for a serious and violent crime where victims can possibly meet with their offender and have a conversation, but it's needed in so many other realms. Not every person who's been harmed by a crime has the offender end up in prison. So what avenues are out there for people to actually connect? And then for the people who've committed that harm to actually respond. And victims have so many questions that end up not being answered through the criminal justice process about, you know, things that maybe happened to their loved ones or something that happened to something they care about. So having the opportunity to actually meet and talk with somebody, I mean, that is just such a transformational experience, and our current system really doesn't allow that.
You know, you mentioned all these different kind of examples. So could you maybe like elaborate on like one story of a, you know, kind of particular inmate, you know, victim case where some restorative justice, some communication was utilized and was very, and was maybe completely or somewhat successful?
One of the components about our work at OSTI, which I think is important to highlight, is that part of our group is that the men will share their crime. So like I said, we're doing groups in prison. So we have things like victim impact panels. But the guys that we're working with, they're not necessarily going to ever meet or be able to meet with their direct victims. So they're learning about victim impact through other victims who are willing to come in and talk to these groups. But part of the work that they do, and, you know, these are very intense groups that meet weekly for the majority of the year. So one of the things that they have to do is share their crime. And many of these men have never talked about their crime, or certainly not in a group with, you know, 10 to 15 people sitting around in a circle listening to that. So it's a very intense process where, I mean, part of the restorative justice philosophy and an important core component of our work is taking accountability for what you've done. And so having to really come face to face with something you've done, I think that that's a challenge for many of us. And then think about the worst thing you've ever done and imagine sharing that experience with other people and, you know, truly being vulnerable and open. And so we've really seen it's been very challenging for men to go through that experience, but it's also been very transformational in terms of how they see themselves in the world, how they see their victim, I mean, how they see their future, really, how they want to move forward with their life and how they want to live differently. And obviously, these folks who come to our groups, you know, they've already done a lot of internal soul searching, I believe, and not everybody is going to be the right fit for our group. Not everybody is going to be able to do this. And, you know, we're very concerned about mental health issues and other issues that might impact somebody's well-being, so understand that this might not be the right process for everybody.
Right. In terms of the, you know, there's the immediate kind of work, you know, that people are doing, right, with these you know, different models and kind of one-on-one reconciliations or what have you. As far as like the larger prison system is concerned, are there things that are being set up, I mean, are already set up, or that are kind of, you know, ways that help people also to, you know, lighten their sentence, or, you know, things of that nature, you know? So not only, you know, just the restorative justice part, but also like, are there ways that this is like helping prisoners and, you know, family members get their loved ones out sooner, or help building their, you know, their kind of their case, you know, in a sense while they're locked up?
Right. But you actually highlight another important component of our work. So the men who participate in our groups do not get any kind of special consideration for parole or anything because they've participated in our group. So that's part of our interest, is that people are genuinely motivated to understand the harm that they've committed and to be accountable for that, and also consider the impact they've had on their victims. So, and I know that the Oregon Department of Corrections, I think there is a growing interest in restorative justice processes and practice, and I can't tell you specifically what might be coming into shape with that, but I know there are conversations happening around how can we utilize restorative justice processes more. And like I said, there's also this facilitated dialogue program where victims and offenders can meet potentially through the Oregon Department of Corrections, and that's a separate program, and that, I believe, also has no impact on sentence length for inmates. So in terms of, like, programs or things happening in, related to restorative justice in terms of limiting sentence time, I'm not familiar with anything. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm just not familiar with it.
Sure. And, you know, hopefully maybe, you know, we'll see more of that happen, you know, out of the work as well. You mentioned that there's people that find out about what you're doing, however they find out, and kind of get involved. What kind of training is available for, like, doing this work? I mean, even if it's not just from, like, your organization. Okay. So for people that are getting involved, which you mentioned that people kind of hear about the project and want to do this work, what kind of training does it encompass, or what kind of things do people need to know, to learn, or what have you?
I think an important, I mean, obviously many of us come from a conflict resolution background or a criminal justice background. I think having an interest in restorative justice is, you know, foundational component. But, you know, we also, in terms of people wanting to get involved in becoming volunteers, we have an application process, and then we have a training, a pretty extensive training process. So people who have facilitated groups in the past, that's always very helpful. People who have familiarity with nonviolent communication practices, we use that a lot as a core component in our work. So anybody who's inclined or interested in those sorts of things are probably going to be well suited for our group. And then, you know, we have training, intensive training, before people start doing this work in prison.
You just mentioned a bunch of really important and crucial skills that people might not be too familiar with. Can you maybe take one or two of those and kind of expound on it a little bit more, and how it's, you know, built into this work?
I mentioned earlier we talked about, we do crime sharing, so the men share their crimes. So a lot of the work that we do in prep for crime sharing, and also just in steeping ourselves into the restorative justice world, is also gaining more skills in terms of how to effectively communicate. So nonviolent communication, it's a philosophy of communicating where people identify their needs and learn how to make requests of other people. So, you know, a lot of the folks that we're working with don't have great communication skills. They might be pretty disconnected from their own emotions. And so nonviolent communication really makes you pause and consider what your own emotions are, what your needs are, and then how you communicate that to others in a way that isn't going to set them off in a negative way, hopefully. And so, you know, there are nonviolent communication groups that happen in prison, so sometimes people who are connected to those volunteer opportunities find out about us, because we are also incorporating nonviolent communication into our work. We also, like I said, the way that we facilitate these groups is really through a process of dialogue circles. So I would say the key component there is really learning how to listen and suspending judgment. Although we definitely ask a lot of questions and we get into things, we dig into things, but we use this dialogue circle or as part of the process of how group functions. So people who have had experiences facilitating those kinds of groups are often pretty comfortable in the groups that we run.
Sure. For the folks that are, you know, again, that are outside, that are getting involved, they have, you know, these certain skills. And can you talk a little bit more, you know, how can people get more of these skills? Like, where are they, you know, available? Or, I mean, if you want to talk about how they're not available enough or something like that.
You know, there is more work happening with restorative justice. Or Resolution Northwest is doing restorative justice in schools. So there are youth in our community here in Portland learning about restorative justice. I know in Vancouver, Clark County, their juvenile court system uses a restorative justice model. So, I mean, I guess the first step is learning about restorative justice, learning about what's in the community, and then there are possibilities to engage with that. So there's our project. Again, there's the facilitated dialogue program through the Department of Corrections. There's the work that Resolutions Northwest is doing. There's the work that's happening in Clark County. So I think, you know, obviously everybody's not going to come into this being an expert already in restorative justice, but I think if you appreciate the values and the approach of restorative justice and you're open to learning about it, then a lot of the work that we do in our training is also going through what is our perspective of restorative justice and how are we using it in our groups with these men that we're working with inside the prison.
So you mentioned, you know, largely the work that you've been doing is with, you know, male-identified, male-bodied persons. And are there or any projects that are going on or will happen for non-male persons, say like in Coffee Creek, for example, or?
I'm not sure. I think that there might be things happening at Coffee Creek, and again, I'm just not familiar, and it's something that eventually we hope to be doing more at Coffee Creek, but I'm just not familiar with specifically what's happening there.
For people getting involved, like going inside to the prisons, which some people, maybe they're doing it, you know, for the first time, and can you talk a little bit about how that works, actually, like getting inside to actually do this work in the first place?
Again, if you're interested in our work, we have a whole process where, you know, people have to get approved through the DOC system. You have to become a prison volunteer. We have our own application. I think a part of becoming a prison volunteer, there's a background check. So, you know, that might immediately exclude some people, unfortunately. And then I think we always do a few visits where people go into the prison. Our guys inside the group, our guys inside also work as co-facilitators with us. So they, veteran guys or alumni guys who have been through the group as participants, then in future years have the opportunity to co-facilitate with those of us who are outside facilitators. So they're also very engaged in the interview process for new volunteers. So new volunteers now go through an interview process inside. And, you know, for some people, they have never been inside a prison. I think many people haven't. And it's, again, it's maybe something that isn't for everyone. It's a intense experience. So it's, you know, those sort of initial interviews and visits on the inside are also just a way for people to gauge what their own capacity is and if it's something that they really feel like they want to pursue.
How does an inmate get involved exactly? Is it just because you're doing the program there, or are there ways like inmates can like kind of, you know, outreach themselves to get involved with these projects or to request that maybe you would come to their particular prison or what have you?
So historically, it's really been at OSCI, it's really been recommendations of the men who have been involved. So like I said, there were originally 4 inmates who really wanted to pursue restorative justice at OSCI, and they were really responsible for pulling together men for the first couple of groups, and that just kind of expanded. The chaplain, our program falls under religious services, so the chaplain is also involved. We have a process for inmates getting involved because, as I mentioned, that process might also not be appropriate for every inmate. At McLaren, there is a faculty person at McLaren who she's really worked to recruit the guys to come and learn more about restorative justice. So this is our second year there. So the first group was just the group of guys that was interested, and now, you know, there's the second group. And there have been some changes at McLaren, so we'll have new guys coming in. And it really is, you know, the people who have gone through it or have started to learn about it, talking about it with their buddies and saying, hey, you should come check this out. So
sure. So this organizing is like, seems like the tip of the iceberg as far as like alternatives to prison. And in your opinion, or, you know, including maybe that, you know, with the organization, but, you know, clearly this kind of work is saying on some level, right, that, you know, things aren't working in the prisons the way that they are now. And if I can ask just kind of like briefly, like the big picture question here, but what do you see happening, let's say, in the next, you know, 20 years? What will it take to make this a national, you know, model or whatever you want to call it?
Well, I think it's actually happening. I think we are, like you said, I think we're on the cusp of something. And I think, as you know, and as you talk about, I'm sure, all the time, the current system isn't working, and more people are becoming aware of the tragedy of that broken system and how it damages our fabric as a whole in society. And so I think there people are hungry for alternatives, and I think this movement, it is happening. And like I said, there is interest even within the Department of Corrections to expand the use of this work of utilizing restorative justice in prison. And so I guess my interest 20 years out and my hope is that this work isn't just based within a prison model. I think it makes sense that this is where, I mean, it's not the only place where it's latching onto, but it is one of the places where restorative justice is grabbing onto is within prisons. But I think we need to see it expanded out more, where people in our communities, again, where maybe crimes haven't necessarily been prosecuted or people aren't serving time, there are still harms that happen in society. And having places where people can go and have the opportunity to really utilize this process and use restorative justice as a way to communicate what they need, I think it's extremely powerful. So my hope would be that in 20 years, we're not just seeing it in prisons or juvenile court, but we're seeing, you know, nonprofit organizations and other community organizations that are really able to utilize this process, offer this process out to the community, and then also, you know, survive as nonprofit agencies. However, they need to figure out the funding for that, obviously.
Sure.
It'd be great if the federal government decided to sponsor restorative justice programs in every school and in every community across the nation.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, why not? They're spending billions on prisons as it is, right? So
yeah,
we can maybe keep people out too, would help. So just in conclusion here, we just got a minute to wrap up. How can people get involved? You know, websites or what have you, kindly just, you know, spell those out as slow as you can so people can catch that for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people want to learn more about us, our work with Insight Development Group, they can check us out on our website, and that's www.insightdevelopmentgroup.org. And then I think also if there's interest in restorative justice, checking out the Northwest Justice Forum is a great group of people that come together every year and talk about restorative justice and what different groups and communities are doing around the Northwest region. Yeah, I think this, again, we're happy to also be a resource. So if people have questions, they can let us know, and we're happy to find the answers.
Great. Thank you so much for all the amazing work that you're doing, and also mention that Mindy is also a musician, if I can mention that, and that you're sending your musical you know, abilities out as well with this work, I'm sure. So thanks again. We'll get you back on soon. I know you mentioned one of the founders is also a formerly incarcerated person, so we'd love to have them on and talk more about this too. So
yeah, we'd love to. So thanks so much for having us, Adam.
Absolutely. Great. And this concludes another episode of The Prison Pipeline. Join us again next week, 6:30 p.m., every Monday evening, same time, same station. This is KBOO, your community radio station. Thanks so much to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Please like Prison Pipeline. You can also look at our archive too, kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Thanks so much to all of our listeners. Free them all. Have a good night.
Mellow Mood Fridays, a live reggae music series, March 28th, April 4th, and 11th. Featuring artists Synergy, Adrian Xavier, The Rising Buffalo Tribe, Positive Vibes, Papa Wastik, Jesse Genda, Archangel, and the African Foundation Crew. Roots, Reggae, and Dancehall. Jamaican, African, regional, and island vibes, dancing, and positive community times. For more information, visit hawthornetheater.com. Sponsored by Mellow Mood Pipe, Mike Thrasher presents KBOO Community Radio, Just Some Reggae Folk, and EMET events.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
And it is Monday, April 7th, 2014. Coming up next, it is KBOO's evening broadcast of Hard Knock Radio, followed at 8 p.m. by A Different Nature. So stay tuned here at KBOO Portland.
Three, four. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
It's history. Never been done before. Never been done
in this
before.
Country. In this country.
What up, everybody? Welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. On today's show, we talk about the police killing of Alex Nieto in Bernal Heights. We talk to his best friend. You don't want to miss that. Later on, we're going to take a trip down to Jackson, Mississippi, and give you an update on the upcoming election to succeed Mayor Chokwe Lumumba, who passed away a month and a half ago. All that and more coming up.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
And I am Vanessa Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio.
Oh,
and you are?
I'm Yuri Kochiyama with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
You know you're dealing with the black terror, less Darth Vader. Only bite my tongue when I rock the crossfader. This is the grand verbalizer, Funkin' Lesson, Brother J of the X-Clan. Give him big up and respect to Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. It is Hard Knock Radio. And about a week or so ago, we talked to you all about the tragic killing of an innocent man from San Francisco, a lifelong San Franciscan, somebody who was studying to be a probation officer, somebody who works security at local nightclubs, and somebody from all accounts that we have talked to, from the people that we've talked to, was a great guy, outstanding community activist type of individual. His name was Alex Nieto. He was killed in Bernal Heights, and many people have been upset about it. There's been a number of town hall meetings. There's been protests, and we wanted to talk with people that were closer to him to get an update as to what is happening. One of his best friends is sitting here in front of us. His name is Ben Bach Sierra. And Ben, welcome to the show. First of all, our condolences to you. We talked to you a little bit about this off air. We don't ever want to take it for granted, and we don't want people listening to take it for granted. when we are able to interview people that are close to somebody who's passed. I think that's tremendously important that people understand that there's a loss and there are people that are grieving, and this is not always the easiest thing to do. But we appreciate you taking time out to share with us, you know, the life of your friend and what has been going on in San Francisco. My first question, let's talk a little bit about Alex. Who is he?
All right. First, thank you for your condolences, Davey. Alex Nieto was a beautiful soul, a person who transcended color lines, age groups, economic classes. This was a homeboy who grew up in Bernal Heights at a time, well, he was born into Bernal Heights when it was not completely gentrified. Now in the year 2014, it is very gentrified. You've got lawyers, engineers, tech workers, etc., living now in Bernal Heights. So there's a very small minority of Latinos, African Americans there. Alex grew up in this neighborhood. He grew up in the Mission. Very a promising individual. Had an associate's degree. Loved deep intellectual conversations. Loved to smile as well. He was a practicing Buddhist. He had traveled to Japan in the past. He knew all sorts of people, from deans to professors to probation officers, community activists. He was a poet himself. He was part of the Mission Peace Collaborative. I took part in many journeys with Alex Nieto. Just a great individual.
I think it's important that we know this. And I say this very seriously for people that are listening. We've had these conversations a number of times over the years. Oscar Grant's uncle, Uncle Bobby, was one of the first to lay this out, and he says that when these things happen, they're the textbook that police departments, whether they're in Oakland, California, or New York City, go to. And the first thing they do is they start to demonize